Hey football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. It's February 1978. And five friends are traveling to Chico, California, to watch their favorite basketball team in action, UC Davis. It was to be a special weekend for the five. The following day, they were going to be representing the Gateway Gators in a tournament to win a trip to Los Angeles, courtesy of the Special Olympics. After the UC Davis game had concluded, the friends drove to a local store, bought some snacks, returned to their car, and were never seen alive again. No one knows how the bodies of Bill Sterling, Jack Hewitt, Ted Weir, and Jack Majura were found 4 months later, miles from where they should have been. The fifth member of the team, Gary Mathias, has never been located. To shed some light on this perplexing, tragic, and baffling case is author Tony Wright. His book, Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five, leaves no stone unturned in diving into this perplexing case. But before we join Tony, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes guaranteed, early releases, bonus content, and much more. You can also click the link in the show notes as always, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support Mysteries and Monsters via Patreon. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, merchandise, and news. Our intro and outro music are provided by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you to Dean Bestel, as always, for his wonderful artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. Once you hear about the Yuba County Five, you'll not be able to shake how this case has got under your skin. And Tony will also be appearing on the upcoming Netflix series, Files of the Unexplained, which covers this as well. When we think of mysterious disappearances, some cases stay with us long after the initial flare of activity burns out. Yet one perplexing case seems himself to have disappeared for over 40 years, only re-emerging into the popular consciousness in 2018. The case of the Yuba County Five is in turn tragic, horrific, deeply saddening, and incredibly baffling. In his new book, Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five, author Tony Wright takes us on a journey into true mystery. Tony, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Well, thank you, Paul. I'm glad to be here, and I'm happy to talk about my book and very happy to talk about the case of the Yuba County Five.
This is one of those stories, Tony. When I first came across this, I listened to a podcast here in the UK called Unexplained, which is hosted by a gentleman called Richard McLean Smith, who's built a stellar reputation over the last 10 years examining very similar cases from around the world. He covers mysterious murders, strange anomalies, odd circumstances, historical cases, witchcraft, anything you can do. And he covered this, I think, at the beginning of 2019, Tony.
Okay.
And it's one of those cases that there are so many facets to this that the first time you hear it or you stumble across it, there's something about it. It just gets under your skin.
It does.
I'm not sure if that's in regards to the circumstances that we'll cover or the people involved in this or whatever, or the fact, as I said in the introduction,
this case just seemed to disappear for so long. And then suddenly it's one of those cases in the modern era of social media and online personalities that has a rebirth. But for you, you're a gentleman that's had a history in history and you work in archivism. How did you come to find the Yuba County Five, Tony? What led you to that point? Because I know sometimes people can write a book and it's almost as if the case has come to them because they want that particular person to write this case.
I discovered the case, I believe, in 2018. I work in local government and archives, and I had these responsibilities of scanning these historic photographs and doing work on a database. And I thought, I need something other than music to get my interest and get me moving through the day. So I decided to listen to true crime podcasts, and I discovered YouTube has a community of people who do original true crime content and videos about unsolved mysteries and the unexplained. I'm a student of the old school, as they say, because I love shows from the U.S. like In Search Of, which was hosted by Leonard Nimoy, and you had Unsolved Mysteries, which was hosted by Robert Stack. And those shows really caught my attention. And when I saw a new generation of people on YouTube doing these stories, I was immediately attracted to those channels. And one is called Criminally Listed, and it's based out of Canada. The show has a theme each week. It's either people who vanished, but there were strange voicemails or strange clues. So I was listening to their 100th episode, and it was a viewer's choice. Hmm. So they picked the top three stories, and the last one was titled Gary Mathias and the Boys. And like you said, that story immediately grabs you. And I thought, wow, this is such a tragedy. This is an incredibly eerie story. Have I heard of this story before? Because I was a huge fan of Unsolved Mysteries. It was never aired. Mm-hmm. Have I heard about it before in a previous podcast? I had not heard that before. It was a new story. So I thought, wow, this is weird. This is fascinating. And when you watch something on YouTube, the algorithm gets you to go to other channels.
Yes.
Well, another channel based out of the UK called Bedtime Stories.
Yes.
Did an animated version. And I thought, oh, this is fantastic, because at the time I was working for a company that was doing comic books, and we do independent work, and the work on Bedtime Stories was phenomenal. Mm. And what they did to the story and sort of the level of animation that was brought to it was superb. I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And other podcasts and original content channels on YouTube started to cover the case. And that was late 2018. As we move into 2019, I'm doing work with a company that does independent comics. We're doing some shows across the United States. I talked to someone that has published books and is working with the company. And I just pick his brain for a moment. His name's David Hayes. He was a great mentor in helping me with this book. I asked him, I want to write a book about true crime because I'm fascinated by this case, but I couldn't find a book at the library. There's not a book at Amazon. He just started bouncing questions over to me. What's the case about? When did it happen? Is it solved? Is it unsolved? Has anyone written a book about it before? And I explained everything. This is a Yuba County 5 case. It seems to have come out of nowhere. It's a 1978 disappearance that's catching fire on podcasts and on YouTube. So there's got to be a level of interest for a book. As 2019 was winding down, I thought, well, I'll write a book. And 2020 seems like a good year to do whatever I want to do in writing a book. And of course it wasn't, but
yes,
I was motivated to write the book. Started making calls, reached out to the families of the five, reached out to law enforcement that covered that, you know, was in charge of the investigation, some members of the media that covered the case, and people who were sort of in the know, either directly or indirectly with the case. So in my research, I met Drew Beeson, who's an author, and he had written a book about the Yuba County Five. I met Shannon McGarvey with Mopac Audio, who did a podcast about Yuba County Five, which includes an interview with Jackie Hewitt's dad, who was the last surviving parent of mm-hmm. the Yuba County Five. Plus, I met people from the UK and I met people from South America who were interested in the case, which was absolutely fantastic. I went to California to actually look at the case files from the 1978 investigation and beyond, any additional paperwork that was added in. And I went up to the Plumas a couple of times to examine where they went missing and just get a feel for the area and just understand what happened February 24th, 1978. And it seemed to be simple to write a book, but as I'm writing the book, my contacts would message me on Facebook or send me a text or just call me out of the blue and say, have you talked to this person? Did you see this newspaper article? Are you familiar with this angle to the story? And so I spent 2020 to roughly, 2023 working on the book. It was a lot of work. I met many wonderful people, tons of interviews, lots of writing, lots of newspapers to read online. Thank goodness I'm in a digital age, and just so much information. And the end result was the book, and here it is. And people are reading about the case. And Drew Beeson referred to this book as the Bible for the Yuba County Five, and he's a Yuba County Five researcher. And I take that as the highest compliment available. I'm really happy, and other people have said that as well. So it's good to see the book out there. The families are very happy with the book, and their blessing was probably the biggest part of this, that biggest part of this project, period.
I think in the introduction, it's one of those strange places that you kind of refer to. I think most people are often surprised about this, especially Californians, Tony, that I think most people's knowledge or interest in the state of California focuses on the Bay Area and LA, and they know next to nothing about anything above Sacramento.
Correct.
All the way up to sort of Oregon and Washington State, up that area. And it's surprising, I think, that when people talk about California, that they're essentially talking about the bottom half of it and don't seem to know much about the area and the history of it. And this particular area, it seems that this case was essentially like the full stop on a very strange period that was going on. There was a very notorious serial killer running amok who had a very strange way of meeting his victims. It's very rare that you find a male-on-male serial killer in the modern era, Tony.
Yeah, the Juan Corona case, unbelievable.
Yeah. Which was very... It just shows you the dangers of transient working in agriculture, because essentially he was picking off victims from farms he was working on, wasn't he?
Yes, and it was something that I learned in doing research about the Yuba County area, which is north of Sacramento, about 45 minutes. And I didn't know it had a very dark past, especially with Juan Corona, who was considered the worst serial killer in America around 1971, when bodies were discovered working in, I believe, in the orchards that surround the community. And I always knew California had a role in the agricultural business in the United States. And I had no idea how huge of an industry it was once I saw it for myself traveling through Northern California, because you'd see almond groves, or you would see they actually grow rice in that area as well. So, numerous crops. And I grew up in the Midwest in the United States. I'm used to seeing farms and agriculture, but I just seeing what is being done in California was really impressive. And the crimes of Juan Corona were shocking when I did my research, and even crime in the area itself during the 1970s of Yuba County and surrounding Sutter County was relatively high. I mean, those towns probably had, you know, smaller populations. I don't think Yuba had 50 or 60,000 people at the time, but I think Marysville had less than 20,000 people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those communities were just running wild with, at times, with crime. And I believe the incarceration rate for either Yuba County or that region was equal to the incarceration rate per population for somewhere like Los Angeles. Unbelievable. I was talking to a member of the sheriff's department who worked those cases at the time, And they said there always seemed to be something going on, and their hands were full. And if their hands were full with Juan Corona, it would, you know, be just as full with the missing men in 1978.
Yeah. I think as well, there is a real sort of oddness about this as well, because I know one of the disappearing five lives in the town of Marysville, which is also a very strange place because it's synonymous with another notorious incident in American history, which is obviously the Donner Party.
Right.
Which is one of those things that when you first come across that case, that is once again, it's one of those stories that you come across in history, Tony, where you it is basically there is a point in that journey where they have a choice between going one way or the other. One way they'll be fine, the other way all hell breaks loose, and they go the wrong way. And when you look back at it and read what happens and find out, it's one of those stories that you are amazed anybody made it out of it, never mind everything else that went on and the ramifications and the allegations that were made and what went on. And it's one of those situations very similar to what happened to the rugby team in South America.
Correct.
Where you put people in a situation where they have no choice to do what they have to do to survive. It may not be palatable. It may not be what we would consider morally correct. But I think for the grace of God, do we go in such circumstances to put ourselves in a situation where it's a case of, do I starve to death or do I utilize what's around me, regardless of how that repulsive might be? And there was a very similar, you know, these are the choices people make at the very end of their life where they've got one or two options, and either way you have to do what you have to do, sadly.
It is, and I was familiar with studying the fate of the Donner Party, but I had no idea Marysville took its name from one of the survivors, which I thought was shocking. But Marysville itself was founded at a time when there's gold in California and there's opportunity, and we don't really look at the history of people moving across the United States to, you know, find bigger and better things, and sort of running into just absolute disasters like the Donner Party. I mean, that's something that's almost mythical in American history.
Yes.
And it's very disturbing, very dark. But, you know, they met their fate in the Sierra Nevada mountains, just like the five met their fate in the Sierra Nevada, where they were up in the Plumas. And I think we kind of forget that some of these majestic, beautiful places that we have, these national parks and national forests, are beautiful, but very, very dangerous. And yeah, you know, reading stories about what happened to, and then there was a German tourist who took a trip through Death Valley, I believe in the 90s or early 2000s. I mean, they just seemingly vanished and died out there.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of forget that these places that we view as beautiful and majestic can be incredibly dangerous. And if you are not ready for the environment, it will grab a hold of you, and it can take your life.
Mm-hmm. I think it is one of those aspects that, once again, people don't consider somewhere like California to be such a dangerous place in winter. And yet it can get horrendous levels of snowfall, as has been shown over the last two or three years as well, Tony. This is not, you know, this is not something that happened in the Victorian era or the birth of the American dream, where people were traveling over there in the gold rush era. These are still incidents that occur, and people have been trapped, and sadly people have lost their life in the modern era due to the perilous nature of, as you say, it's beautiful for 9-10 months of the year. But when that snow comes up there, it's a different ballgame.
It's unforgiving. I mean, I live in the Midwest, and we have freezing temperatures. We have below freezing temperatures. We have blizzards. We have, where I live, I'm near one of the Great Lakes, and we have lake effect snow, which is not wonderful at times. I mean, it can be beautiful, but there are other days where you just wonder, why do I live here? But yes. I mean, California, once you get up into the mountains and you're up in the Sierra Nevada, that's another ballgame, as we say. And the snow is unforgiving. It's feet of snow. I know I'm using our American measurements, but I mean, it's an absurd amount of snow at times, because over here we'll say, oh, well, we had this much snow. And recently I watched some video of a recent snowstorm out that way, and people would open up the door to their home and it's snow.
Yes.
they're trapped in their home, and I'm thinking, just to get out of that, it just has to be a nightmare. And the area of California has faced droughts in the past, but now due to the weather, they're seeing record rainfall, they're seeing record snowfall, and this is very similar to what was happening in California in 1978 when the men went missing. Yeah. It went back to 77, high rainfall, high snowfall. And when the men went missing on February 24th, 1978, there was a decent amount of snow in the Plumas National Forest. So these guys were traveling into an area that was very cold, very snowy, and very dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, when we look back at how we get to this, the starting point of all this, we've got a group of young men who have been brought together through their personal challenges. I know in the book you say you kind of put a sort of disclaimer on there that I think often people forget, even though we're talking about something 46 years ago, some of the language used to describe some of these men is deeply offensive in the modern era. And I would suggest it was quite offensive at the time, depending on who you spoke to, Tony. I think it's one of those things where certain words seem to be very off the cuff in normal conversation. And thankfully, we seem to be a lot further down the path, the majority of us who treat people as we find them, rather than trying to label everybody. And these guys were from very different backgrounds. They've got a variety of mental challenges. A lot of them would say that it hadn't held them back. And obviously there was a lot of change going on in the way that people were viewed due to their educational struggles, shall we say, in regards to that particular era, as they were trying to open up society to allow people to live a freer and more fulfilling life and make sure that people's opportunities weren't blocked due to educational needs or as we would say over here, some of the sort of special educational support that they would require. And yet these men seem to sort of bond and through a love of basketball. And the thing that I think one of the most tragic aspects of all this is that these lads were on the cusp of really achieving something, because this whole event occurs when they, for some reason, decide they want to go and watch another team play basketball before then they themselves play. Because I think, were they playing for a chance to play in the Special Olympics at that time?
Yes. The five men, Ted Weir, Jack Madruga, Bill Sterling, Jackie Hewitt, and Gary Mathias, were part of an organization called the Gateway Projects, which was an organization for people with disabilities and mental illness in Northern California, which provided job training and sort of life skills and life coaching for people with disabilities and mental illness. And so the five of them were part of the Gateway Projects basketball team, and they were the Gateway Gators. The plan was to travel towards Sacramento to a community called Rockland, where they would be in a basketball tournament for Special Olympics. And if they advanced, they would go to the state of California's main Special Olympics event in Los Angeles. And it was going to be held at the University of California, Los Angeles, or UCLA, I believe July 1978 or June 1978. Mm. But the trip included a visit to Disneyland, which I assume would have been an added bonus to participating in the state Special Olympics. Mm. So having that level of excitement for going to this basketball tournament, which would lead to something bigger, the guys were putting out their uniforms early. They were getting their shoes all cleaned up. They, you know, one person, Gary Mathias, told his mom, "Hey, don't you let me oversleep." Ted Weir kind of scuffed his new tennis shoes while trying to test them out and asked his mom for some help getting them cleaned up. So they were ready for this tournament. And to get ready for it, they decided to travel north to Chico, California, because their favorite basketball team, UC Davis, was traveling to Chico State University to play a basketball game. And that basketball game was Friday, February 24th, 1978. And on Saturday the 25th, they would have had their tournament. So it worked out for them that our favorite basketball team has an important game, because with basketball, college basketball, during February, you're getting close to March and you're playing for your conference championship. You might be able to go to the division, I believe they were a Division II basketball team in the United States, so they would have gone to the playoffs, and maybe they could have played for the Division II championship. UC Davis was having a great year. This was kind of an easy game for them against struggling Chico State, and UC Davis ended up winning the game, which had to be a big, exciting moment for the guys before their big game. So you watch your favorite team win, it gets you motivated. You go get some snacks after the game at a local convenience store. You get on the road and drive home. But instead of going home, you divert from the normal path and end up hopelessly lost 75 miles in the wrong direction from home. And you're in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada mountains, middle of nowhere, a lot of snow. And it's absolutely bizarre that these men just vanish off the face of the earth. And the next day, the parents begin working with law enforcement to launch a major investigation.
I mean, this whole thing, I mean, these guys were obsessed. All their families said that they loved basketball. If they weren't playing it, they were watching it together.
Mm-hmm.
They had a clear love in it. And like you say, they were obviously, I think they were wanting to use the Davis team as an inspiration, I suspect, Tony, to get them ready for their upcoming tournament. I think they would have taken a lot of confidence and felt really good and thought, well, my favorite team, we want to experience that ourselves. And it's, I think when you're into sports, you can feed off the success of people you admire or teams that you appreciate. And I think this was clearly what the plan was for these guys. And yet, like you say, everything up to this point, they were so excited. They were clearly really bonded. They knew what they needed to do. They wanted to be as prepared as possible for this. Seeing this team for them would be the icing on the cake of probably the best weekend these guys had ever had. And for it to go as badly wrong as it does, even from the point of them watching the game and leaving it, everything after that, none of it makes sense.
No, it doesn't, because all they wanted to do was go to the game, and they would have left home, which would have been the Yuba County area, and that would have been maybe 6 p.m., 6:15 p.m. They would have made a 50-minute drive to Chico. The game ended somewhere close to 10 p.m. Their trip to the convenience store was not that far away. So they should have been on the road sometime after 10 p.m. and they could have been home, depending on traffic, by 11 p.m. They could have had some rest. And the next morning they were to get up and meet at a department store in downtown Marysville around 8 a.m. to get on a bus and go to the Special Olympics tournament. But as the night progresses into the early morning hours of the 25th, the parents are up and concerned, and they're calling each other saying, did Ted come home? Did Jackie come home? Have you seen or heard from Bill or Jack or Gary? And everyone's starting to say no. These family members start to call their kids and other friends and family members, and they kind of rally the troops and say, okay, hey, the guys are missing. They never came home. They try to call the Yuba County Sheriff's Department 8 a.m. on Saturday, but the Yuba County Sheriff's Department said, hey, these guys haven't been missing long enough for us to begin an investigation. So if they're gone for so many hours, then we can get something going. So it was up to the families to do their own investigating. So they checked the department store where the men were supposed to meet, and they didn't see him there. And they even drove to Chico, California to go to Chico State University in the gymnasium where the event was held. No luck. They're driving some of the highways, and there's two highways that run parallel to each other from the Marysville area up to Chico. There's two state highways, 99 and 70. And these lead directly to Chico, and you're thinking, okay, well, maybe the car broke down. Maybe they got stuck somewhere. And they're driving and looking around, and there's no sign of them. They're trying to call hospitals. They're trying to get in touch with anyone they can to see, did this happen? Did that happen? there's no sign of them. They eventually are able to get law enforcement involved by 8 p.m. on February 25th, which is Saturday. No sign of them Sunday. No sign of them Monday. But late on Tuesday, February 28th, 1978, a forest ranger from the Plumas National Forest makes a call to law enforcement and says, I found the car you're looking for. So these guys were traveling in a 1969 Mercury Montego. I found the car. Great. Where is it? And they tell them it's near a place called Rogers Cow Camp in the Plumas National Forest. And people begin to rush to that spot, and 75 miles to the, to the northeast in the wrong direction, way in the middle of nowhere. If you're driving through the Plumas National Forest, it's no man's land up there. It's very twisting, winding roads. The elevation is way higher. I mean, you're going up, 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 up into the foothills and mountains. You've got very rugged terrain. You're going to see snow. The temperatures are going to be way, way, way colder. I mean, the temperatures are going to drop. And you're going to get below freezing temperatures. These guys left for the basketball game wearing very light jackets, very light clothing. It was cold for California winter, but it was manageable. But when they go to the Plumas, it's much colder. It's below freezing. There's snow. They're not wearing the right clothing. They're not wearing a winter hat or gloves. The jackets they're wearing are not that well insulated. And to be exposed to those elements in the Plumas National Forest is quite dangerous, because hypothermia would kick in quickly. And these guys, if they're out of the car, are doomed. And so what they find out is Jack Madruga's car is abandoned on a road near a place called Rogers Cow Camp in the Plumas National Forest. It's not a paved road. It's a rutted road. Jack Madruga did not like driving on poor roads. He flat out would refuse to drop off anyone at home if he knew a pothole was, a possibility of something for him to dodge. He liked a nice, smooth road. And for him to drive these men up into the Plumas, park a car on a road that's really rutted, covered with snow, and in some spots possibly mud, and just abandon the car, and all five of them get out and vanish into the wilderness. It's just bizarre. There was no reason for these guys to be up that way, and there was no reason for them to leave the car. If you look at the road, they would have had to, on their way home, exit into a town called Oroville, and they would have had to take this highway called the Oroville-Quincy Highway to get to the place where they abandoned the car. And it's not a situation where you take a wrong turn and go, oh, I'm lost. Well, what do I do? I mean, this is a very time-consuming drive. I've done it before during the day. I've done it during the night. And there's no way you just end up where they ended up on accident. It's an exhausting drive, but you have plenty of opportunities to turn around. And there's ways that you can just look and go, yeah, this isn't the way back to Marysville. Because when you're driving to and from Chico or out of Marysville or out of Yuba City, the roads are flat. It's just pretty much a straight road. You'll see some of the orchards. You'll see homes. And when you're taking the Oroville-Quincy Highway, you're going over a pretty big bridge that goes over Lake Oroville. You're traveling through foothills. There's pine trees. The terrain looks rugged. The roads wind. There's snow. It's not home. And everyone that knew the driver, Jack Madruga, said he knew the area. He knew how to get to and from places like Chico or Sacramento. He was reliable at driving the others. And he would go on trips with Ted Weir, Jackie Hewitt, Bill Sterling, or Gary Mathias, and they had no problems going places together. They didn't have a history of getting lost There was never a story where the family member said, oh, well, years ago, those guys got lost. And that was a scary incident. That never happened. It never showed up in the investigation. Family member said that Jack Madruga could take him somewhere, and they felt very confident in him as a driver. And if they were running late, they would call home and say, hey, we're probably running 15, 20 minutes late. We just stopped somewhere, but expect us home at such and such time. And with, you're right, that game was of utmost importance. So missing that game, what was, I mean, that was unthinkable to the five. It was a very important game for all of them. They were excited about the fact that they could go down to this tournament. They could basically win and go to Los Angeles, go to Disneyland, and then just enjoy, you know, time down in Los Angeles during the summer. It was a win-win situation for these men, but somehow they end up lost in the Plumas National Forest. They're way off course. And the opinion, which I think was at the time and still today, is that, you know, four men with disabilities and one man with schizophrenia disappeared and vanished, and it's their own fault. But in talking to the families, that this wasn't the case. This was something going horribly wrong, and they've never had the ability to figure out what went wrong that night.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
I was going to say, that's one of the things that's always struck me about this case is when I look at the initial investigations and some of the points that people bring up, a lot of people at that particular time did sort of fall into these cliches that, oh, well, you know what these kind of people are like. They probably didn't know what they were doing. They weren't the most intelligent. They've got themselves in a situation they couldn't get out of. And yet everything that their families knew, I mean, these lads had the wherewithal to be a successful sporting team. They travelled extensively. They went everywhere. Their families had confidence in them going. They were respectful. They always kept people informed. None of that makes excuses. And I think sometimes when you deal with authorities that get cases like this, for them, they just want to go point the finger at the victim and say, well, it's their own fault because they weren't very intelligent. And therefore, what do you expect? And yet, there's nothing to support that. It's one of those things that you just think, I mean, obviously, we live in more enlightened times these days, Tony. And yet, that seems to be at the first point of it all. I think them getting into this sticky situation is quite odd. I mean, and yet, this is nothing compared to what goes on afterwards. Because this, the story, the thing about this story is it's got more layers than an onion. Because every time you think, well, that's incredibly strange, something else then follows on and you're like, what on earth was happening here? Because even after this, you've got this really strange scenario that once the search begins, that this gentleman, is it Joseph Shones,
yes,
who's got a cabin I think in the same area, who also gets stuck due to the weather. This poor guy ends up having a mild heart attack and he's stuck, he can't do anything, and he starts seeing flashlights and he's calling for help and he sees lights moving about and he thinks it's all a bit confusing. I think he said something about he thought he saw a pickup truck appear, but then he said he wasn't really sure because at that point he was absolutely delirious with pain. And this is the thing that always strikes me as amazing in one of these situations, is that by the morning the pain has subsided enough that he was able to walk 8 miles down the road to a lodge, I think it was.
Yes.
And the manager took him to the local hospital where they say, oh, yeah, you've had a heart attack. That alone on its own is one of those kind of strange aspects to a normal situation is peculiar. As part of this, that's even weirder, because then you're thinking these guys, if you've driven up the wrong, if you've driven up a road and got stuck, because obviously the car didn't show any damage, it hadn't had any bumps or scrapes or any reason for it to stop. I think it still had gas in it, so it could still drive. You would say, well, if your car gets stuck, what do? You get out, you walk back the way you've come. And yet that, there are so many things about this that none of it makes sense, because regardless of these gentlemen's challenges, if these guys have the ability to drive cars and visit places and play basketball, they've got the sense to walk back down the same way they've come, surely, Tony.
Yes, and that's true. I mean, like we said, the five people in the car, Jack Madruga's driving, and with him are Ted Weir, Bill Sterling, Jackie Hewitt, and Gary Mathias. And Jack Madruga, Ted Weir, Bill Sterling, and Jackie Hewitt had intellectual disabilities at varying degrees. But Jack Madruga had served in the Army. He was a competent driver. He was a very nice person. He was well-liked and respected. And his family knew that he was reliable and trustworthy. Now, with him was Gary Mathias, who he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. He had struggles with schizophrenia. He, too, served in the Army. But Gary had started a regimen of medication to help with the schizophrenia. It doesn't cure schizophrenia, but when he was not taking medication, he had numerous struggles with law enforcement. But when his family stepped in, made sure he was taking medication, seeing professionals, his life went on a different track, a much better track. So all of these men are involved in Gateway. They're moving in the right direction in life. They go to this basketball game. They end up in the Plumas National Forest. The car does get stuck on a road that goes to nowhere. And that is even strange why they chose this road to abandon their car, because it's covered in snow. The car is stuck, but four of them could have left the car and pushed it as Jack Madruga kind of rocked the car back and forth to get it unstuck. But while they're in the middle of nowhere on this road, Joseph Shones is there as well. And he suffered a heart attack, and his car is stuck on the same road. So right there, that's very interesting, because Joseph Shones and this group of men are stuck on a road in the middle of nowhere. What are the odds? At this time of day, and Shones watches the men go off into the night, which is his words, not mine. And depending on the story that he tells to either law enforcement or to the press, that there was a pickup truck that followed behind Jack Madruga's car, and the men either got into the pickup truck or ran off into the Plumas National Forest. So we have Shones experiencing a heart attack, varying stories. He has been an individual who's been referred to as the town drunk and sort of a teller of tall tales.
Mm-hmm.
So you have an unreliable narrator with a penchant for drinking, which right there, that's a recipe for disaster. And I talked to someone who was his neighbor, and he said the worst thing that happened to those five was running into Shones, because we don't know what happened. We don't know if Shones actually saw these guys.
Yeah.
Because there was a reward for any information on what happened to him. And the amount of money being offered at the time was enough to sort of raise some eyebrows and go, oh, okay, if you need information, I'll get you information.
Yes.
Let's go.
Yeah.
But what happens is, you know, with Shones' story, it gets a little bit strange, because he tells different stories. It's strange what he tells the press, that, you know, this truck is following him, and they come up to his car and look in and disappear, but they run away, or they run away into the woods. I mean, the guy's got varying degrees of interactions with people that night, but he gets back in his car and waits like 3-4 more hours and then walks 8 miles somewhere and says he has some chest pains, but asks for aspirin. And they actually drive him home. And then his wife comes to find him and says, what's going on? And basically explains that he's abandoned the car and the, so many miles up the road. And she decides to go get it. She comes back because she can't get it unstuck. And she decides to take him to the hospital for his heart attack. And so you've got this guy, Joseph Shones, whose stories are all over the place. And law enforcement, who they've got to be baffled. They've just got to be absolutely floored with all the information that's coming in. And now they've got to search the Plumas National Forest with another group of law enforcement because it's in another jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Another jurisdiction will come in because they're close to the area as well. And they've got experience looking for people who are lost in the Plumas, and they know time is not on their side. And they've lost days looking for these guys in the Plumas because that car is basically up there for roughly 4 days before it's called in. Mm-hmm. And so the time that they've lost trying to search for these men is, it has to be made up somehow, but the process of finding them is a little bit painstaking because they're working from the car out in a circle almost to search the land. And the land is rugged. It's not flat. It's very treacherous in spots. There are some areas of the Plumas that the skilled and more advanced hikers would never go because it's such a drop in elevation and the terrain is so treacherous, they avoid those places. And if law enforcement's got to look, it's going to be very, very difficult. One of the searchers, I think he breaks his leg. I think another guy has a heart attack. They try to use a helicopter, but the weather's not cooperating. I think they're able to get it back up in the air again to do some research or do some searching, excuse me. And this goes on from February 28th through March into parts of April, but it's not until early June 1978 when a group of guys who are on a motorcycle trip in the Plumas National Forest come across some trailers, which were used by the Forest Service near a place called the Daniels Inc. Campground, and they discover the body of Ted Weir in one of the trailers. He's on a bed because it was used by the Forest Service for their workers and other people who were maybe doing whatever up in the Plumas for work or for recreation as a place to stay. And it's stocked with food and fuel to heat the trailer. And Ted has passed away. So they find him in that trailer. They find that there were army rations of food or sea rations that someone had opened them and eaten the food. They discover that Gary Mathias's shoes were left in the trailer. They believe Jackie Hewitt had been in the trailer. So as Ted Weir's remains are found, they start searching the area around the cabin. And as they go a few miles away, they discover the remains of Jack Madruga, Bill Sterling, and Jackie Hewitt. Sterling and Madruga are close in proximity. Hewitt is further away, but closer to the cabin. And the families are absolutely devastated. They continue the search through part of June of 1978 to look for Gary Mathias, but they give up at a point where they just feel like we just can't find this guy. It's impossible. There was an Air Force base that's close to the area. They asked if they could do aerial reconnaissance of the area, but they told law enforcement, we can do it, but we're not going to be able to pick up a human body doing aerial surveillance. That's a needle in a haystack. We can't justify doing something like that. We just don't have the technology. And the Plumas National Forest is like 1.1 million acres of land. What they're able to cover and what they can do, it's very limited. And people have said that there are probably parts of the Plumas that people just can't get to because it's incredibly dangerous to walk through that area. because you're just going to fall down a steep, you know, it's going to be a steep drop, and you're going to get injured. So once the search is called off, June 1978, the story fades away. Yeah. I mean, it just goes away. I mean, it becomes like local folklore. Like, oh, do you remember that story? And when 2018 comes around, the story is brought back to the spotlight. And people like me are discovering the case or interested in the case, start to do research and just try to figure out what happened to these guys February 24th, 1978, because this case doesn't make sense. It's we tell people, yes, look, four of the men did have intellectual disabilities. One person did was diagnosed with schizophrenia, but they were at good points in their lives. And this disappearance is very, very uncharacteristic of these men. They sort of lived scheduled, detailed lives where they wanted to go from point A to point B. They wanted to be at home and bed at certain times. They didn't like being away from home. They didn't care for the Plumas National Forest. They didn't care for the snow. They didn't care for the cold. They didn't care for the dark. And this is where they abandoned a car for no reason. Many of us feel that something happened that night where there was something or someone met up with them and everything just went wrong that night for those guys. Like, yeah, it just basically fell apart in a way.
Yeah. I know you were saying about Sean's, Tony, and his explanation about what happened, but there was also somebody else that came forward, which when you look at what happened after this person came forward, you kind of think, well, that story doesn't make sense either. Cause I think somebody claimed that the guys had turned up in a pickup truck the day afterwards. They claimed to have seen them
at another convenience store, which was further south from where they were.
Yeah.
But closer to where they lived, which definitely didn't make sense because the clothes they're wearing didn't match.
Yeah.
They're in a pickup truck. Jackie Hewitt was viewed using a payphone, and he didn't. I mean, he would use a telephone, but he wasn't the biggest fan of a telephone. Mm-hmm. And if they were so close to home, they could have just taken the truck back home and said, hey, we're home. Sorry about what happened. But again, it's one of those stories where you have to take into consideration the amount of money being offered for information. And it turns out it's bogus because it draws law enforcement further away from the area they should have been searching, down to an area where you know the story's bogus.
Yeah, because even on a common sense look at it, Tony, you would think, well, if they were seen the day after they were supposed to have disappeared, why did they end up going back there? Just straight away you think red flag. This just doesn't make sense. They're clearly just trying to get the money here.
Yeah, and even there were people calling from surrounding communities where they claimed to have seen the men, like one of the guys from the group, two of the guys from the group, they just saw someone that they thought was a person who might have had a disability and assumed it was the men. So law enforcement has to chase all these leads. They even bring in psychics to help with the case, but the information they provide is not of help. Doesn't lead investigators anywhere to finding the men. More letters come in as far as great conspiracies, including a rogue group of Marines who abduct people using helicopters. There's there's talk of cults. There were cults in the area, but again, these men lived very happy lives with their families. There was no need for them to join a cult. And someone said, some of the cults in the hills at the time, they would have people call home for money, and the men would not fit into these cults. They just weren't the type of people that they would recruit. I mean, it didn't make any sense. And there was a lady who lived in the Marysville area who claimed to have received phone calls about the fate of the men. This guy keep calling and telling her, like, those guys are dead. I did it. And law enforcement tried to get this lady to trace the calls or get information on the calls, which she couldn't. And it just adds to the level of just craziness to this case, because, as I mentioned earlier, the five were part of a group called the Gate, or part of an organization called the Gateway Projects. Gateway was a place where they could do training for jobs and they could get employment. They could also have life coaching. But back in 1975, the place was targeted by an arsonist. And the arsonist even killed the director in an act of arson. So there was something bad going on at Gateway, but yet these guys were able to persevere. And there was even discussions, well, could this be linked to the disappearance of the five? What happened at Gateway with the arsons 3 years earlier? And law enforcement said, no, it doesn't seem that it could be linked. But again, could there have been something that led them to this demise that's linked to that somehow? It's possible. I know Gary Mathias had been in a couple of altercations before the night the men went disappearing, and we know the name of one person but not the other. However, I've been told that there were some people in the community who were not fond of Gary, who sort of had beef with him, who may have wanted to get even with him over something. But then again, that's just rumor. And so you hear all of these stories, you collect all this information, talk to the families, talk to law enforcement, and even talk to people who lived up in the area or who were living back in Marysville and Yuba City. And they're pretty much all on the same page that something went wrong that night, and for them to end up where they did, and the fate that they had of, you know, their untimely deaths, doesn't make any sense. And what they've been trying to do since 1978 is just fill in the blanks. Why did they leave the highway and go into this town called Oroville? Why did they get on this road that led them over a dam near a reservoir and drive up into the Plumas National Forest? Why did they abandon their car on the road that was basically in the middle of nowhere on an unpaved road? Why did they leave a car that still had gas in the tank and they could have kept themselves warm? And why would they go into the snow and they're wearing the wrong clothes? They're not wearing the proper shoes. I mean, they're probably their feet and their clothes were getting wet from walking through the snow. The frigid temperatures weren't helping, and that leads to hypothermia. Some of them end up at this trailer, but there's no way that they know how to turn the heat on for the trailer, but they're able to get into the food. They're signed. We definitely know that Ted Weir was in the trailer, but not anyone else other than possibly Gary Mathias. Would they have left their friends behind while walking if they just couldn't walk? And I mean, that's kind of hard for me to believe how close these guys were to leave someone behind. So all of these questions still need to be answered, and we're trying to get answers. And that's why this book is out there, to get some sense of closure on what happened in February 1978, why these guys just vanished for no reason following a basketball game in Chico, California. It makes no sense whatsoever.
Every time you think that you might have got a solution, or you think, well, this is probably what happened, you stumble across something else. Like you say, like when Ted's body was found, they speculated that he basically survived for quite a long time after everybody else, and yet had made no attempt to go anywhere. You know, his personal effects were in this cabin. Nothing was stolen.
Right.
I know there's some mystery allegedly about a watch that the family said what didn't belong to anybody, that was found in there. But once again, you would suggest that if these lads had met a nefarious end, people are going to rob them. They're not, you know, if you're going to murder somebody, Tony, you're not really going to be bothered about leaving a wallet behind. You'll take everything you can, because even that doesn't make any sense of why anybody would want to kill these guys and then not take, as we say, even with certain serial killers, they are known for taking trophies.
Right. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And the fact that the other guys are sort of scattered around the cabin. Like you say, these are firm friends. These are not the people to leave each other to the elements. They would probably, I think as anybody would do in these kind of circumstances, you'd do whatever you could for the people that you care about, and you wouldn't abandon them. I think as well, one of the things I've noticed, and people have speculated about this, and I know Gary's family have probably had to deal with this a lot. Do you think the fact that Gary was a diagnosed schizophrenic has been an easy solution for a lot of people, because everybody's gone, well, he must have done it?
Oh, it is, because that's their slam dunk answer. Well, the crazy guy did it. But
yeah,
if Gary, if you see his arrest record between probably 1971, 1974, it's eye opening and you go, oh, this guy. But then you see that arrest record isn't nothing. It's outside of those two fights that he has at parties. It's nothing from what, 1975 to 1978. And Gary's living a life that's now what seems to be incident free. So yeah, Gary's the easy culprit because, oh, Gary went crazy and led them to the Plumas to die. But if Gary's going through something like psychosis or whatever, why does nobody remember? I mean, nobody came forward from the game to make a comment about Gary. This guy was at the game. He was acting strangely. He was bothering people. He was causing a scene. Nobody who was at that basketball game at Chico State University had anything to say about Gary.
Yeah.
The clerk who was working, Gary didn't make an impression on that clerk at the convenience store that the men went to after the game. Because the clerk remembered all of them were pretty much in the store shopping for snacks. And if Gary was going through something, something could have gone off and said, yeah, this guy, something's up, something wasn't right. And people just have this idea that, well, just Gary snapped on the ride home. And I've done some research on schizophrenia, and to the best of my knowledge, it seems that if something's going to happen, you kind of see it coming.
Yes.
That you know something is going to happen. And also what I've discovered, that people who are diagnosed with schizophrenia are more likely to be the victim of a crime than the perpetrator of a crime. And so, again, Jack Madruga, who's driving the car, if Gary Mathias is doing something, they could have pulled over to the side of the road, opened the door to the car, had Gary get out. He could have closed the door. And they said, Gary, see you later. We're not dealing with this tonight. We're going home. And Jack Madruga had done that before, where people had gotten on his nerves. It was the group where they went somewhere together, I believe in Sacramento. They got on his nerves. He just got in his car, abandoned them in Sacramento, and said, I'm not dealing with you guys. That could have happened.
Yeah.
I mean, Ted Weir, one of the guys in the car, knew Gary. And if you press Ted's buttons, he could take care of business if he had to.
Mm.
And so blaming Gary seems easy. But at the same time, there's people within the car who could have taken control of the situation, like four guys against one.
Yeah.
And it'd be a lot for Gary to commandeer that car. And I don't believe Gary went up there with some crazy vision of what to do.
Yeah.
I mean, those guys, Jack Madruga was the driver. He would have said, yeah, no, I don't want to go to the Plumas. No, thanks. We're going home. That's where we're heading. And if they got lost, there were plenty of opportunities to turn around and go home.
Yeah.
The road that they abandoned their car on went to nowhere. It's an old, like, logging road, off an old stagecoach road. So it's not a highway. It's not some sort of state route that you can take home, or it's not the scenic ride home. You're going the wrong way. You're going northeast instead of south. And it's dangerous territory because of its rugged conditions. It's cold, there's snow. You're in the middle of nowhere. There isn't a place to stop up in the Plumas that I knew of that fill up your tank if you were running low on fuel.
Yeah.
So nothing makes sense about this case, but I know the story had to be told, and this is why I want people to know more about the Yuba County Five, as the group was collectively referred to, and understand who they were as people and see that it's not them that's the problem. It's something that happened that's the issue, and we're trying to figure out the something that happened. Mm. And hopefully this book can just either get someone to talk who remembers what happened at the time. Because I've heard rumors from people around the community, and these are from people who are not linked in any way. So if they're telling me similar stories, either there's a shred of truth of this out there, or it's just a completely fabricated tale that was passed around the community, or, you know, told from one person to another.
Yeah.
But still, we need to know what happened. And if we can get to the bottom of the case, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. I suppose final point I want to sort of address, I would imagine one of the ramifications of things like this, I think people often overlook, Tony, once again, and I think we've seen a bit of a sea change over the last five or 10 years in regards to how people used to deal with gruesome crimes. It would not necessarily glorifying, but at the sentence, there seemed to be a focus on the perpetrator rather than the victim. And I think one of the aspects of things like this is, I think people look at the story and don't look at the ramifications, because at the end of the day, these people still have relatives alive who mm-hmm. probably have so many questions that remain unresolved, as for anybody who can, you know, who spends a small amount of time looking into this case will come away with more questions than anything. I think you were fortunate enough to speak to all the families in regards to that. What kind of sense did you get about this? Were they surprised that this case had come back to life? And if so, how did it feel? Were they uneasy about the attention in them so far on from its original occurrence?
I spoke to four of the five families. The Sterling family has stayed out of the spotlight since I believe 1978. Mm. But they were all surprised that the story had come back. They were surprised that there was this much of attention. They were, I would say, hesitant at first to talk, but the more that we talked over the phone or would text each other or communicate through something like Facebook Messenger, we built a relationship where we could talk more about the case and the legacy.
Yeah.
And it's still hard to talk about because with the families, they're not happy with what happened as far as like the final answer, which is they got lost, which is what seemed to be the consensus of the law enforcement agencies that worked together, that they were trying to say, well, the guys were going to stop in this small community near the Plumas and they took a wrong turn and ended up in the middle of nowhere. Well, there was really no reason for them to make that exit and visit that small community in the middle of nowhere. There was no reason for them to be lost in the middle of nowhere. It makes no sense whatsoever. And I think that's what the families have been trying to say since day one. This is way out of character for these guys. They wouldn't have gone this way. They wouldn't have ended up where they ended up. And it almost seems as if, you know, the world just kind of shrugged its shoulders and said, what are you going to do? And as the story disappeared, the families, I think in a way, kind of gave up on hope on finding a solution. But now that the story's back in the spotlight, they feel like maybe this is their last chance to get some sort of closure. But we don't know when the closure's coming or if it's coming. We hope it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I hope it's soon. Because, you know, all five men do have siblings that are still alive. They have, you know, some of the nieces and nephews that were around at the time are still around. All the parents have passed away of the five. And, you know, even some of their siblings have passed away. So
yeah,
I think too many people have questions, or all the families still have questions. And they just don't get it. And they know something went wrong. I think that's the consensus of all five families.
Yeah.
That something went wrong. They weren't told what happened. And they just think it was just due to their disabilities or mental illness that this situation brought them to their demise, but they feel something else was at play. Mm-hmm. And they feel that the something else was never fully investigated.
Yeah. I think regardless, Tony, these young men, they were loved, mm-hmm. they're missed, and the family still want answers. And I think with the quality of the work that you've done in pulling this book together and the level of research and, the, as you say, the respectful way that you've treated, because I would imagine the families were very sort of reticent, because with the greatest of respect to yourself, Tony, I would imagine they probably had to sort of fend off a few nefarious inquiries in regards to this in a more ghoulish nature more than that. And I think they obviously needed to sign you out and make sure that you were the right type of person to assist them more than anything.
I agree. And I'm glad that we were able to work together towards this book. And I'm very happy that they're happy with the book.
Well, it is a phenomenal piece of work. Like I say, it's one of those cases that once you discover it, it gets under your skin. You can't shake it. There is an overwhelming feeling of tragedy and sadness about five young men on the cusp of probably greatness in their lives, and it all going so horribly, horribly wrong, and nothing after that basketball game makes sense. So I just want to say thank you very much for you taking the time and the diligent research that you've got to create this. Where can everybody get hold of it, Tony, and anything else you've got in the fire going forwards on the back of it?
Well, for the book, Things Aren't Right, The Disappearance of the Yuba County Five, you can find the book at Amazon. And you can either get the paperback or you can get the Kindle version. So both are available at Amazon for easy shipping. You can also get the book from Genius Book Publishing, who is the publisher of the book. So whatever you choose to do as far as supporting Amazon or the publisher is fine with us. As far as what I'm doing, basically the unofficial book tour, I guess you would say, talking to different podcasts and newspapers and people that are interested in the case, about the book and the case and the research, which I'm grateful for. I thank you, Paul, for being very interested in the case and letting people know about it. And moving forward, I do have another case that I've begun research on. I can't say anything about it right now, but you'll hear something from me, hopefully, sooner than later about what that's about and what the next steps are for a book, which is being planned for this research.
Fabulous. Well, I certainly look forward to your next project based on your body of work so far, Tony.
Well, thank you.
It's a phenomenal piece of writing. And anybody that has an interest in strangeness, like you said, right at the very beginning, as a similar vintage, Tony, as someone that grew up, I find it as baffling that something like Unsolved Mysteries never covered something like this. Because I've seen some of the cases of disappearing people that they've covered on this. Nothing matches this at all. So that in itself is a bit of a strange aspect of all this as well, that so many other investigative programs steered away from it for so long. But as I said, thank you so much. It's been brilliant to talk to you get your feelings and thoughts on this case and how it's moved you, clearly learning about these people and the families behind it.
Yeah, and thank you again, Paul. This was a great interview and I appreciate the time, and I'll definitely want to be in touch with you and still talk more about the case and other things moving forward. And I thank you for all your hard work doing what you can do to, you know, let people know about these cases and having a great platform. And thank you so much. I'm very, very grateful.
I look forward to our next conversation. Take care.
Take care, Paul. Have a good evening.